Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Riley Revilla, and I am a student at Georgetown University. I also serve as the student liaison to the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society, as the Federalist Society takes no positions. Today's program is titled From the Courthouse Steps, Little versus Hecox and West Virginia versus BPJ. We're very pleased to welcome an excellent group of panelists. Rachel Morrison is an attorney and fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where she directs EPPC's Administrative State Accountability Project. Her legal and policy work focuses on religious liberty, healthcare rights of conscience, the right to life, non-discrimination, and civil rights. Sarah Parshall Perry is vice president and senior legal fellow at Defending Education. Before coming to Defending Education, she served as a senior legal fellow for the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, part of the Institute for Constitutional Government at Heritage, where her work centered on civil rights and the proper role of the courts. One note for our audience before we begin. If you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen, not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them later in the program. With that note, I will turn things over to our speaker to start the conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Riley, and thanks to everyone who's joined us today. This is kind of a momentous occasion. I'm thrilled to be with Rachel, as we were discussing right before we got started today. We're not just attorneys. We've been following this particular case very closely, and we're not just former administration officials who have served both at the EEOC and Department of Education. So we understand sort of the mechanics behind what civil rights law looks like in practice, but we are also mothers to girls. And in fact, my daughter is playing a college sport. So this particular case impacts me distinctly, so I'm thrilled to be joined with her. Before we start our discussion, let me talk a little bit about how we got to where we are today. This case, this pair of cases, Hecox versus Little and West Virginia versus BPJ, were a set of challenges to two state laws. The first was passed in Idaho in 2020. It was a Fairness in Women's Sports Act. It was the first state in the country to pass a Women's Sports Protection Act, and it barred so-called transgender girls or biological males from participating on any athletic team in the K through 12 or higher education format. Since then, 27 other states have passed those particular types of laws, and the challenge was brought specifically by a collegiate athlete who wanted to try out for the girls' track and field D1 team. This male did not make the team, but did in fact play club athletics. The second challenge comes out of West Virginia and their Save Women's Sports Act, which was enacted in 2022. The challenge to this particular law came from a middle school boy who identifies himself as Becky Pepper Jackson and wanted to try out for the girls' track and field team. As these cases wound their way through the particular federal circuits, the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit actually determined in both cases that there was either further fact-finding that needed to transpire or that these particular claims were successful on their face. And when the Supreme Court took them both, they were argued separately. The Idaho case involved only a challenge to the constitutionality of Idaho's law based on the Equal Protection Clause, and West Virginia's included both an Equal Protection Clause claim, but also a Title IX claim. So we're going to break down the opinion, talk a little bit about what we thought were surprises, or perhaps weren't surprises, were fairly predictable outcomes, and hear from you all as well. If you drop your questions, as Riley mentioned at the beginning, then we can address them as we're going through. I want to start out with this. The ultimate holding here was a 9-0 victory on whether or not West Virginia and Idaho can, under Title IX, ban biological males from competing in girls' sports. And on the equal protection question, that was a 6-3 victory with the three liberals in dissent, as could have been, I think, largely predicted. Kavanaugh took the pen on the majority opinion that was joined by all the conservatives with separate concurrences by by both Thomas and Gorsuch, which were both excellent in their own way, and which we'll get to in a second. But let me start with this, Rachel. Were you surprised at any of the votes or the ultimate outcome in this particular case?
I wasn't surprised after oral argument. We saw that there was a mass retreat, especially on the Title IX issue from the individuals challenging the state laws in the case at oral argument. They seemed to concede Title IX and in a lot of ways, and then put all their eggs in the Equal Protection Clause basis. But what I think is surprising is just the massive retreat on the Title IX issue just in general over the last couple of years. Just a few years ago, the Biden administration issued a rule saying that Title IX's prohibition against sex discrimination in federally funded educational programs and activities meant that you had to allow participation based on gender identity. And so we went from that a couple years ago to this 9-0 decision by the Supreme Court on the Title IX issue. So I think that's surprising maybe in context, but after oral argument, it didn't actually surprise me that that was the result. And I am pleased to see that that was the result.
I also was not surprised by the fact that this is a fairly cabined opinion. In other words, the Supreme Court did not go so far as to say states must separate scholastic athletics by biological sex per Title IX, for example, even though there was a fairly extensive discussion of sort of a textualist, I think, down the sticks analysis of both the law itself, Title IX, when passed in 1972 and signed into effect by Richard Nixon, but then the Javits Amendments in 74, and then again in 1975 with the implementing regulations, every one of those. And they cited, the majority cited Loper-Bright versus Raimondo Enterprises for this particular proposition. They don't prove conclusively what the particular statute means, but they can be illustrative and actually teasing out what the term means. And it was very clear based on the sort of evidence that the court had in front of it that in 1972, sex in Title IX meant biological sex. Now, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson took issue with that, calling the definition of sex a little more capacious than biological sex. We can get to that in a second. But I think here it's important for people who are listening to understand that this was a sort of permissive act of representative democracy. In other words, this is very much akin to the Dobbs and Scrimeti decisions that we saw from the Supreme Court. Again, cultural watershed cases that also came at the end of their respective terms. This is one of those questions that is best left to the people and their elected representatives. And toward the end of the majority opinion, Kavanaugh actually cited repeatedly to the Scrimeti decision on just that particular basis. Did you find anything about his particular opinion on either Title IX, that question, or the Equal Protection Clause to be particularly noteworthy or novel in its application?
Well, I think kind of related to what you were saying, one thing that I was pleased to see is that the court said that Title IX, that sex in Title IX means biological sex. So in the Bostock decision, which involved sex discrimination in the employment context under Title VII, the court just merely assumed that sex meant biological sex and didn't actually definitively decide that that means that's what it means for Title VII. So I was pleased to see that that was definitively decided here. Mm-hmm. The liberal justices, I think, would have preferred that it was just assumed, leaving the door open for future arguments. But I think this really just takes the legs out of some of the arguments that we had been seeing in court and really just helps focus the decision and future litigation that we might see. Related also, I think, to what you were saying is that this is somewhat of a limited decision and that it's permissive. It allows this kind of states can have laws and regulations that limit participation on girls and women's sports to actual girls and women. Footnote one is important, and I point folks to, is they do recognize that there is litigation ongoing on whether Title IX actually requires states that have women's and girls sports teams to limit participation based on biology, not identity. And so I think, but they didn't address that issue. And so I think that's something that we are going to see more cases on in the future. Mm-hmm. I know this administration, Department of Education, Department of Justice have been advancing that theory in their enforcement actions and in their litigation. And so I think if it's not decided maybe universally by the circuit courts, we might see that issue back up at the Supreme Court in the coming years.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point of emphasis here, is that this is not certainly the end of the story. As Kavanaugh wrote, both the International Olympic Committee, the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, the NCAA, and 27 states have all said, this is an issue. We are going to relegate participation only to biological females because of inherent differences. And that term, inherent differences, came up over and over again. Interestingly, United States versus Virginia, an opinion by Ginsburg about whether or not women could be constitutionally prohibited from admission to a military academy, came up for both sides of the proposition when it was the majority versus the dissent. And in fact, Kavanaugh cited it multiple times for the notion that physical differences between men and women are enduring. One of my favorite lines from that opinion, that's ever more, I think, applicable and sort of noteworthy today. But Sotomayor cited it for the proposition that the Equal Protection Clause analysis portion, and here the Supreme Court, the majority opinion, where it fractured from the three liberals, determined that, yes, it was a sex-based classification. Yes, it was very clear it was a sex-based classification, but there were important governmental interests, and the legislation was substantially related to those important interests. There was not a constitutionally required case-by-case analysis for every individual conceivable exemption. The Constitution did not require that under intermediate or heightened scrutiny. That was a strict scrutiny backdoor attempt by the actual petitioners here, which I thought was very interesting. But Sotomayor actually cited the same case for the proposition that this had been too broad a categorical exemption, and she would have sent this back down to the trial courts to determine future and further fact-finding on whether or not these athletes, and particularly BPJ, had specifically disadvantaged themselves. Any sort of preconceived or pre-existing biological distinction or inherent advantage would have been muted because of puberty blockers. Now, of course, there was litigation on this. There were dueling expert witness reports in this case about whether or not there is or is not inherent athletic advantage. I think the general consensus on this is that, yes, there is inherent athletic advantages. Some of those may be blunted to a certain extent, but Sotomayor cited U.S. versus Virginia for the proposition that there was further fact finding needed. When you read her opinion, did you find it at all persuasive that she said, you know, we really have to go back to the drawing board and hear from more people about whether or not there is an inherent advantage? Or were you, as I think I was, in addition to Kavanaugh, just happy to say, listen, contested policy issues, let the people fight it out in the chambers, just like we said in Dobbs, just like we said in Spermetti?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's a policy issue that would need to be addressed by the legislature. Can you imagine what this would look like if every athlete, male athlete that who identifies as a girl and wants to participate on a team is going to court and trying to say, like, here's the medical interventions I've done, here's my current ability, here's, like, who do you compare it to? The best female athlete, the worst female athlete, an average female athlete? I think it just leads to a host of practical problems. This is something that's been brought up in a number of talks I've given on Title IX for FedSoc chapters at various schools. And I call this the if you suck enough rule. Like, if the male athlete sucks enough, then he can participate on the team. But I think it's just not the purview of the courts to get into all of these decisions where, like, oh, maybe it makes sense in some circumstances to have exceptions or different rules or something like that. Like, that's not what the law requires. And so the court shutting that down and not opening that door, which then would not even just be limited to this issue, it would be something that would extend to any type of equal protection clause challenge under intermediate scrutiny. And so I think the court rightly saw that this was just not going to be workable and something yeah. should be shut down. And then kind of related to that, one thing I was happy to see is at the end of Kavanaugh's opinion, he addressed kind of like well, what's the harm? It's just one athlete argument that gets brought up a lot of times. And really is just like, look, sports is a zero sum game, mm-hmm. like what we're talking about. And one athlete can have a massive impact across the board for a lot of different female athletes. It's like one female athlete that doesn't make the team, one female athlete that doesn't get playing time, one female athlete that doesn't get to participate in finals, one female athlete that doesn't get an award. And so this, and then the impact on other teams or folks you're competing with as well, as far as having a male athlete that then is presumably, if they're playing, giving an advantage to that team, if the male athlete is good enough to be playing instead of another female athlete on the team. And so I think just really recognizing the impact even just one male athlete can have for a whole host of women athletes. And then I think Kavanaugh was a great person to write about this because he's, I think, the sports justice.
Yes. And he has two daughters of his own, by the way.
I think he coaches their basketball teams and yep. like he really gets sports. And so I think having someone to really appreciate the value of sports, for all athletes and just the hard work and the impact and the benefit that sports play. It was great to see that recognition throughout the opinion and putting it all in context.
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting because on page 28 of the majority opinion, he really goes into Coach Kavanaugh mode. In fact, when he's got that sort of, long soliloquy about, putting their championship trophies or their all-league awards on their bedroom shelves, they learn to endure losses with grace to lift up their teammates. You could just hear him talking to the girls on the team, which I thought was really a great way to end the opinion. And also with a closing note of humility and grace, recognizing the humanity of all the students involved, right? And he was very accurate and I think sort of merciful to the extent that he could be within the confines of the law for the individual circumstances that attended both of these two students, one in middle school, one at the college level, and saying, listen, it's never a happy day when an individual loses out on an opportunity to play on a sports team that they want. But again, this is a zero-sum game, right? There are winners and losers. Ability does play into the equation. Title IX does conceive of and permit sex-separated teams. So I think it was a great way to really end the opinion overall. I want to ask you a little bit, because you and I have been following sort of the regulatory history. We talked a little bit about Bostock, but when do you sort of pinpoint the fact or the chronological import of when we started to see these trans-inclusive sports policies? Was that a relic of the Obama administration? Did it really sort of only germinate in the Biden administration? What's your take on that?
I think it really took off after the Supreme Court's decision in Bostock in 2020. And then the Biden administration came in shortly after that. And so I think there had been some of these arguments and cases and policies like kind of percolating a little bit. But really when I came into the issue was during the Biden administration. And I think it really took off. And Bostock was the lone star that the Biden administration was looking to reinterpret every prohibition against sex discrimination to include transgender status or a gender identity. And so that it was in basically every context, and like not just sports, not just education, it was in insurance, it was in bathrooms, it was in all of these different aspects that Bostock's decision really just did not address at all. But that was, I think, the impetus and the starting point for a lot of courts to jump on board. And kind of related to that, I think another interesting point is that this involved both the Equal Protection Clause and the sex discrimination law, Title IX. And so we've seen a lot of the gender identity and transgender status type discrimination claims arise both under sex discrimination, non-discrimination laws in various contexts, whether that's Title IX or Title VII or Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, and then also under the Equal Protection Clause. And so something like the challenge to the law, Tennessee's law in Scrimeti, just involved the Equal Protection Clause challenge. But in a lot of the litigation on a lot of these issues, related to gender identity, we see both the Equal Protection Clause and the non-discrimination statutes, which are similar, but obviously have different analyses. And I think the court's just flat out rejection of Bostock being relevant at all, and just not like, we don't even have to get into it because it's not relevant here. It's completely different from what we're talking about. I think will be helpful to shutting down a lot of these arguments that we're trying to pull in Bostock into all these other contexts that Bostock did not address at all.
Yeah. And it's interesting because as you and I were talking beforehand, Gorsuch cites his own majority opinion in Bostock, basically saying, well, you know, the majority opinion said that Bostock does not apply. And that's an argument that certainly holds legal water. But I think it does apply. And by the way, it only supports the proposition that Title IX permits sex-separated sports. And in fact, he talked about the fact, as you and I have both discussed, that biological sex was the starting point, right? It was that initial sort of North Star within the Bostock opinion that often gets lost in the outcome. It is the way Gorsuch actually began that opinion. And so he's saying, we never strayed from a biological sex definition in Title VII. We're not doing so here. And by the way, employment is completely different than sports, because in one, you cannot conceive of or take into effect sex at all. The other actually mandates sex consideration for purposes of equality and fairness. I've called Title VII sex prohibitive and Title IX sex permissive, in that that's sort of the way that the statutory frameworks are laid out. One of the things that I wanted to mention was the fact that Lindsay Hecox, in September of 2025, tried to moot their own case. And they filed a suggestion of mootness. I found this very interesting because Sotomayor takes as a given that Hecox's case is moot and doesn't even deign to address those particular principles in Hecox's case in her dissent. But interestingly, in footnote 9 of the majority opinion, Kavanaugh points out specifically that when you've got a change in position after cert is granted and it would insulate that particular case from judicial review, you have to look at that with a very steely eye. And this was a circumstance where there was nothing in the record to indicate that this individual had suddenly ceased to have an interest in playing in girls' sports. I was glad to see that addressed. Were you surprised that the mootness argument did not get more, I think, airtime in the majority opinion?
No, I mean, I think once they decided they weren't going to moot it, there wasn't, right? They moved forward, and the BPJ case had both the Equal Protection Clause and the Title IX claims. So in a lot of ways, the result would have been substantially, or essentially identical, even without the Hecox case, even though there are, you know, maybe some additional considerations with that case that were worth addressing. But I did want to go back to one thing you said about Kavanaugh's concurrence. I think the way he views it is there's kind of two different issues. One, is it like sex discrimination? And then two, is it unlawful sex discrimination, right? And discrimination just meaning kind of different treatment on the basis of sex.
Yeah. So as he pointed out, and this was from Scrimeti, every piece of legislation classifies one way or another. That doesn't always amount to discrimination.
Yes. And so then I think this actually really tracks with what the dissents were arguing as well in their view, except they kind of came to, well, I guess under Title IX, they agreed. But like in the sports context, Title IX permits sex discrimination or, you know, kind of the separate teams based on sex. And so like, that's not unlawful sex discrimination. So like the Title VII context, it doesn't permit differences in hiring based on sex. So it's not only a sex-based distinction, but it's also unlawful sex discrimination. So I think that's kind of the way he was looking at it. But he again, quoting some of the Bostock language, said some broad statements like discriminating against a person for being homosexual or transgender necessarily entails discriminating against the person, at least in part, because of his biological sex. And I think broad statements like that are somewhat problematic and self-contradictory, depending on how you apply it into this in the instance. I think none of the other justices signed on to this, and this seems to be a little bit different from how the majority in Scrimeti and the majority here seems to be moving away from Bostock and really trying to limit Bostock to hiring and firing in Title VII, and the focus on sex and not really focusing on the sexual orientation or transgender status of the person, but really having sex be the focal point. I'm not going to bring in these other concepts, which I think muddy the water with the analysis when you take those statements out of context.
Yeah. And there was indeed, I think, and we've yet to take this particular issue head on. The issue of whether or not transgender status is a sort of quasi-suspect or suspect class for purposes of Equal Protection Clause scrutiny has yet to be taken on, because in the Scrimeti decision, it was very clearly, this is a regulation based on age and medical diagnosis. We're not making a distinction based on transgender status. Here, the exact same thing. We are saying sex is distinctly at issue here. This is a regulation, a restriction based on biological sex, but it satisfies intermediate scrutiny. At no point has the court said, and by the way, even if it were to consider transgender status or classification or restriction based on transgender status, that wouldn't meet Equal Protection Clause heightened scrutiny. Now, that did not prevent Justice Thomas from weighing in and citing back to Justice Barrett's concurrence in Scrimeti, which I think is excellent, points the way forward, in which he says, we have in the past had occasion to consider additional suspect classes, mental illness, poverty, immigration status, for example. Every one of those, they have declined anything beyond the concept of immutability, as was discussed, for example, in Frontiero versus Richardson, which the court cites in the majority opinion here in the case. I think it's very notable that there are justices who are willing to kind of pick around the edges of that question of whether or not a class is sort of quasi-suspect to include gender identity or transgender status. Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, assumes it. She just goes immediately to the end point without addressing the fact that after multiple requests for individual characteristic representations and recognitions for protected status, for heightened scrutiny, the court has time and again only held fast to immutable characteristics, not, as Justice Thomas wrote, mutable ones. And I think we're going to see that soon enough. I think before too long, the court will have to wrestle head on with the question of whether or not it's willing to stray from that bright line of immutability when it comes to suspect class qualifications and characteristics. I think, you know, and my sense about this is that they would be disinclined. I think Barrett wrote such a great concurrence in Scrimeti, just saying, listen, I'm going to lay out, and in fact, I had predicted she might be the one to author the opinion, because if we were taking a transgender restriction on its face, she might be the one to sort of chart the path forward on an equal protection clause analysis based on protected characteristics. But do you think that's a question that will come up sort of relatively soon in litigation, about whether or not we treat sex and gender identity or transgender status as the same level of suspect class and both subjected to heightened scrutiny analysis?
I'm not sure if we'll actually see that issue in a way that the Supreme Court wouldn't sidestep it, maybe in the same way we've already seen, because I think a lot of what we've seen is distinctions based on sex being claimed to also be distinctions based on transgender status or gender identity, right? We don't see an exclusion of, like, no one who identifies as transgender can participate at all, right? Right. There's a male team and a female team, and then, like, whether you're male or female, then that's the team you have to be on. And then the folks trying to say that that's gender identity discrimination or transgender status discrimination. So I think that's different in kind than a rule that says no transgender identifying student athlete can participate. And I don't see those laws that exist. So I think a lot of what we have been seeing are essentially sex-based or maybe other types of classifications, like the medical use or age in the Scrimeti case. So I'm not actually sure if we will see that issue, because I don't see kind of overt exclusions based or classifications based on transgender status or gender identity. Right. I was going to say, I do think we, I was going to say, we're coming up at the top of the half hour. We do have to, I think, read a couple of the quotes from Justice Thomas's concurrence that I thought.
Please, because we didn't get to that, but it was great.
So I think Justice Thomas really just getting to the heart of the issue of like, what does it mean to be a human person? And like, what is male and what is female? He says, a man does not have a legal right to compete against women just because he believes that he is a woman. And then at the end, he says, men and boys with gender dysphoria are not women or girls, even if they believe that they are. Sex is an immutable biological characteristic. It is binary, and man and woman, boy and girl are the terms that correspond to adults and children of each sex. To use language to obscure reality, to show indifference regarding the truth, is to lie to the public and cease to treat our fellow citizens as equals. It's really refreshing to see not this obscuring of language, such as like transgender girl, or, and you're like, wait, is this a female or a male? And that really just, I think, concedes a lot of the arguments and it's just speaking truthfully that men are not women. And so I really appreciated that.
I did too. You know, his concurrence was about a page and a half long. It was very brief, but boy, he cut right to the chase and made that final point about failing to treat our fellow citizens as equals if we lie to them, essentially, about the reality of biological truth, citing from abusive language. And it's interesting because one of the questions is the discussion about sex being immutable, but whether or not that could be substantially changed by a transgender surgery, making transgender status equally immutable. And the answer to that is there are only two reproductive systems. There are only two gametes. There are only two sexes. And even those sort of disorders of sexual development or so-called intersex conditions, there is still one predominant or the other. There is no third sex. And so anything that can be changed, like an identity, a self-professed internal, subjective, malleable sense of one's own identity is not immutable. It is not a characteristic about which you can do nothing, but is in fact, just by its very nature, changeable. So I knew we were going to do this. We got rolling and we're already 2 minutes past. So I'm going to kick it back to Riley, lest we run afoul of the time clock here.
You just can keep going all day. I think
good, we can great, all day.
Great victory for the rule of law and for girls and women and women's sports.
Yep. Hear, hear.
I want to thank our panelists for sharing your expertise and opinions on this important issue. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of the Federalist Society's programming, please visit their website at fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.